Some 7 or 8 years ago at Amherst College, where I used to teach, we gave an honorary degree to Jacob Lawrence, who's a great American painter, an African-American painter, who did, among other things, a series on John Brown of paintings, 22 panels. He was famous for his series on Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, Toussaint Louverture, John Brown, the Great Migration, and so on. But the museum at Amherst brought the Jacob Lawrence series to Amherst College for a month and put it in a room about the size of half of this room, all 22 panels. And I'll never forget it. I was asked to do a gallery talk a couple days before commencement. And I wasn't sure what I was going to do. I had never seen the paintings except in books. And I went in by myself, I think the day before I was supposed to speak, and just I was all by myself in the room with the 22 panels. Some of you have perhaps seen the paintings. They used to be owned by Hampton Institute. I'm not sure if that's who still owns the series or not. And I spent some time in there, and I came to the realization, all I have is a photocopy here, but then at least 20 of the 22 panels, and depending on how you looked at it, perhaps in all 22, Lawrence had a crucifix of some kind. There was either explicitly a cross on a wall, or there was Brown on the gallows, or Brown hanging, or twisted knives, or twisted rifles, pikes. There seemed to be a crucifix in every painting. And I, of course, did the stupid thing when I met Mr. Lawrence, ask an artist what they're doing, and they're not going to answer you. Gee whiz, Mr. Lawrence, why do you have crucifixes and all of that? And his answer, he was the loveliest man you'll ever meet. His answer was to say, he said something like, what kind of wildlife do you have around Amherst? Do you have red foxes here? You dummy, I'm not going to tell you why I had crucifixes. But then I got him talking and he said, I said, well, so how did you painted these when you were so young? He was born in Atlantic City, but he's raised in Harlem. He started painting in the late 20s, the end of the Harlem Renaissance. And he painted that John Brown series in the early 30s. I said, how did you come by your vision of John Brown? He said, from the streets in Harlem. He said, John Brown was one of the people everybody talked about. He said, people talked about Frederick Douglass, people talked about Harriet Tubman, people talked about other heroes, Lincoln. But he said, everybody knew something about John Brown. I said, you mean what's in your paintings you got from conversations? He said, I read a few things. And at that point, what would he have read? He might have read Du Bois. He might have read Robert Penn Warren. He might have read Villard. I don't know exactly who he read, but he said, I got it from the streets. And I was just stunned at that image. Well, the point of telling you the story, our visitors, is on the morning I had to give the gallery talk, this wouldn't surprise us in the least today, and it wouldn't even probably make page one of the New York Times, but that very morning in Jerusalem, there'd been a bus bombing, 30 people slaughtered, all over the cover of the front cover of the New York Times, and they brought in a busload of fifth graders to attend the gallery talk. So there I was. I'm going to talk about John Brown, revolutionary violence, these paintings on the wall, full of this bleak, passionate power of crucifixes, to fifth graders and my colleagues. This is a much easier audience, frankly, I must say. But it was one of those moments where one had to stop and think that talking about revolutionary violence is not a simple thing. It's not just something that's safely in the past. It doesn't just rest back there in the pastness of the past. It is always still part of our lives. That's why we're here, in part. We're not just here because we're nostalgic for Civil War era history. Maybe some of us are. But it's more than that. We're here because this man, this guy, did something, acted out of a certain set of passions and compulsions, be they his own very private passions and compulsions, or be they much broader social passions of the time, that changed this country. And he did it with deeds, and he did it with forms of violence that never make us easy or at ease or settled. I'm always a little suspicious when somebody just says, oh, John Brown was right. Okay, sure. Of course he was. I mean, he was right. I agree with you. He was right. But let's talk about what he really did. And let's talk about why. That's why I loved Benet's poem that I know many of you have used or heard before. St. Vincent Benet's John Brown's Body, the long epic poem that he did in the 1920s, has that passage embedded in near, somewhere in the middle where he asks us the right question, I think. Benet's lines, I'll recite them. Many of you will remember these. Benet says, the law is our yardstick, and it measures well. Oh, well enough when there are yards to measure. Measure a wave with it. Measure a fire. Cut sorrow up in inches. Weigh content. You can weigh John Brown's body well enough, but how and in what balance do you weigh John Brown? He had no gift for life, says Benet. No gift to bring life but his body and a cutting edge. But he knew how to die. Now, it's Brown's death I want to talk about today. And why not? That's why that book where we are. He laid in state here. We're going to go to his grave. It is Brown in death. It is Brown in the aftermath. It is the Brown that has been constructed over and over and over through time that is the truly lasting and significant John Brown. That's not to take anything away from the, you know, our fascination with his life. It is a fascinating life, a suffering life, a Rolling Stone 19th century family life that is not unlike some other families in the 19th century, but it's certainly a prototype. It is in his death that we find the evolution of this of forms of martyrdom and myth around his image. He is one of those people we can safely say who is in some ways the most beloved of Americans and in some ways still the most loathed of Americans. I was just in a PhD dissertation colloquium not 3 days ago this week. I have a graduate student you're going to hear from up here and probably in 5 years be inviting him to speak. His name is Blake Gilpin. You heard it here first. He's going to do a dissertation. He's a brilliant young man. He's going to do a dissertation on John Brown and cultural memory. Now, people have written around this subject, and Merrill Peterson has a little book out on it, but he's going to look at John Brown from the moment of his death through time and all the manifestations that John Brown appears in fiction, in film, in poetry, in scholarship, in popular writing, and the host of ways, including events like this. I tried to get Blake to come up here this weekend, but his girlfriend's graduating from college, so he doesn't have his priorities straight. Several historians have shown how John Brown, after the capture at Harper's Ferry, and particularly during the trial, when he makes that extraordinarily eloquent speech, which is quoted over here on the wall, if you're wondering why I'm pointing to the wall, that's part of the passage is over there. And then especially during his month in jail, when he writes over 100 letters from November 2nd to December 2nd, 1859, he sought to create, in many ways, his own martyrdom. Bertram Wyatt Brown, in an essay, said that Brown converted martyrdom into what Wyatt Brown called his creative vocation. All the anger, the bleakness, the mordant spirit, the suffering, the heartache of the life he had lived, and the rage that clearly he had against slavery, against injustice, against oppression, against the American government, and against whatever the rest of the demons were in John Brown's spirit, turned in that period in jail, apparently, and there's plenty of evidence for this, to a kind of serenity, a gentleness, a peacefulness. There's a letter where he has that line. He says it to his wife. I don't imagine how this must have affected her. when he says, you know, I've never felt so happy in my life as I feel right now. I mean, for her, that must, she must have thought, oh, really? How many kids have we had? I mean, well, he made himself into an emblem of atonement. He awaited his hanging. He said his words with all joy. And it really was a Greek sense of tragedy, I think, that he had himself, and certainly many of those who would manufacture the John Brown legend had probably cut their teeth on Greek forms of tragedy. He was allowed the opportunity during that month in prison, in jail, to compensate for all of his failures in life, whether those were business failures or personal failures, however we might judge them, with what he now created, which was a kind of warrior's self-willed death. He wanted them to hang him. I mean, the worst thing that could have happened for Brown at that point was for Henry Wise, the governor of Virginia. Remember, he's hung by Virginia, not by the federal government. The worst thing that could have happened for Brown would have been for Henry Wise to do the frankly more politically intelligent thing for Virginia, which would have been not to hang him. Alexander Wise, the great-great-grandson of Henry Wise, who signed John Brown's death warrant, who was the governor of Virginia and interviewed John Brown famously. Alex Wise is a lawyer and lives in Richmond, Virginia, and is the president and leader of this effort to create a major new museum in Richmond about the Civil War. They're going to call it the Tredegar National Civil War Museum, and the whole aim of it is to tell what they call all three stories, the Union story, the Confederate story, and the African-American story. And they just had their unveiling, or their groundbreaking, or undraping, as it turned out, 2 weeks ago in Richmond. And a lot of us were there for that. And Alex has this sense of family lore that is very deep about, you know, his great-great-grandfather. At the same time, he's now devoted to helping create an interracial history. It's an interesting family situation. At any rate, on this theme of Brown's self-willed martyrdom, you need only go read one or two or three of those letters that he wrote from jail. When I was doing my Frederick Douglass research way back when, I bumped into one collection of those letters is at the Pennsylvania Historical Society. I don't know exactly how they got there, but that's where they are. And they are amazing to read. Day in and day out, he wrote letter after letter to family members, to his wife, to newspaper editors, and so on, and so on. In one of them, a letter from jail, he says, I quote him, "Christ, the great captain of liberty, saw fit to take from me a sword of steel after I had carried it for a time, but he has put another in my hand, the sword of the Spirit." And then writing to his wife, he declares, you've heard this one before, "I have been whipped, as the saying is, but am sure I can recover all that lost capital occasioned by that disaster by only hanging a few moments by the neck, and I feel quite determined to make the utmost possible of that defeat." Now, does this mean he had a death wish? I don't think that's the right term. Does it mean he understood the meaning of the symbolism of Christian martyrhood? Yeah, I think he did. "I am worth inconceivably more to hang than for any other purpose," quote unquote, he wrote to his brother. And in the wake of his execution, in poetry, song, and a host of other ways, Americans and people all over the world, especially European poets, constructed the John Brown myth, or the John Brown legend. An American Christ who died for the nation's sins, who tried to convert the nation's crimes into a lesson that would change it. Now, for the rest of this talk, I want to focus on what I think are, this is, anyone can come up with their own list, but I want to focus on just four questions that I think John Brown's story always challenges us with, especially in our own time now, of a war on terrorism, of a world where every day this term now, terrorism, is somehow part of our vocabulary. And the term itself, perhaps, has almost become so ubiquitous that it's almost become like the word tragedy. Nobody uses the word tragedy anymore in a deep, meaningful way. Everything's a tragedy. You know, thunderstorms are tragedies. Car accidents are tragedy. Everything's a tragedy now. That's probably because of newspeak. But at any rate, four questions. The first I've already suggested, and I'll come back to it, is what are the meanings and uses of martyrdom? What does martyrdom really mean? In any particular cultural tradition, what does martyrdom mean? Secondly, how do we deal with the idea of revolutionary violence? Then, 1859, or now? When someone acts in history by using violence in the name of a political or a religious cause, when is it justified? John Brown's story always challenges us with that. And it was very interesting for me since September 11, 2001, every time I teach about John Brown in a class, seminar, or lecture, to just throw it out to my students. Was John Brown a terrorist? You know, to put it on a question. Sometimes on a paper, but often just in person. And he's gotten to be more and more of a terrorist since 2001 in the way that they answer that. Because in their mindset, this was a guy who committed violence in the name of religion. That equals terrorist. Third question, and this is really a series of those questions you've all thought about. John Brown forces us to face a whole host of ambivalences and contradictions that are not easy. That's why I love to teach about him. You can always get students' attention. What is that list? I mean, you can all make your own list. He's both inspiring and disturbing. I mean, if he's only inspiring and doesn't trouble us and disturb us, we probably haven't looked very closely. He worked for the highest ideals, and yet he sometimes used the most ruthless deeds. There's a majesty about him, and there's a folly about him. He was, as so many called him, a monster to some, but to others, he's a saint, a warrior saint. He killed for justice. Is that a contradiction? Killing for justice. Some would say yes. Some would say no, not at all. He forced a conflict. In fact, he did this to people in his daily life, didn't he? He forced a conflict between this very 19th century conception of higher law on the one hand and human law on the other. The law says this. Yeah, so what? Said a John Brown. The law is wrong. The law is immoral. What do you do in the face of immoral law? John Brown's always a prototype for that. He's also a great example of how the avengers of history, of being one of those, what we might call the avengers of history, who do the work that the rest of us won't, or couldn't, or can't, or some might say shouldn't. But he is one of those avengers who acted for other people. And it's one of the most fascinating things about John Brown to me has always been the way politicians condemned him, Republicans condemned him, and then used him to shine the light on slavery. Or as Frederick Douglass once said, they all consented to his death and then went home and taught their children to honor him. Well, he should die, they said. He committed many crimes. He's a criminal. But we should honor this criminal. A fourth question. And the third one, there's a whole series, but it's just this way in which John Brown forces us to face some of the most difficult contradictions about human nature and about history and the place of violence in history. The fourth question, or the fourth fact or point, it may seem simple, but it's very important with young people. He was a white man who killed whites to free blacks. And given the depth of racism in America in his time, given the depth of racism in this country even now, this part of John Brown's symbol has one of the deepest meanings, especially for blacks themselves. If you go back and look at African-American poetry through time, it became almost an obligation that in the late 19th and in the 20th century, African-American poets had to write their John Brown poem. Langston Hughes, Robert Hayden, Michael Harper, on and on and on. Everybody, and Jacob Lawrence's paintings. I mean, they had to get. If all Americans have to get right with Abraham Lincoln, African Americans had to get right with John Brown. Lerone Bennett, the African American historian, said of John Brown, quote, "He was of no color, John Brown, of no race and no age. A colorless John Brown was a sort of necessary feature or fixture in the narratives that African Americans began to tell themselves about their story in America. There needed to be at least one white John Brown, because if there wasn't, then who could you trust? Where would you go?" Or Michael Harper, a current living poet, one of my favorite jazz poets, teaches at Brown University. He did a John Brown poem called History and Captain Brown. And there's a line in it where he says, "Come to the crusade, not as Negroes, but as brothers." And then the poem sort of floats off into this deracializing of John Brown. It's as though his whiteness is rendered irrelevant. Now, let me return to the first three of those questions I raised: martyrdom, the meaning of revolutionary violence, and the set of contradictions, because you can package them all kind of into one big problem about John Brown. How do we react to revolutionary violence? It's everywhere in the world. Violence in God's name. Lockerbie, Scotland, Oklahoma City, Jerusalem, Lebanon, the IRA, the Unabomber, and then come right through time to our own time, September 11th, day in, day out, a car bomb here, a truck bomb there, take your pick. It is a method of politics in the world we live in. Abraham Lincoln, of all people, said of John Brown, said, quote, "He was an enthusiast," that was Lincoln's word for him, "who fancied himself commissioned by heaven to avenge an oppressed people." Now, Lincoln probably meant that as a critical comment, but he also was essentially accurate. The word enthusiast may bother us, but he did fashion himself the spokesman, the actor for, the avenger for an oppressed people, and in that he believed he was right. But the problem here always, and here I'm going to put the hat on of a historian, the problem always is context. It's the context in which revolutionary violence occurs. It's the cause for which it's done. And on any given day, in any given place in the world, we might be surprised which side of a question we'd find ourselves on. The 1850s, this is one of the reasons I really do like David Reynolds' new book. I thought Reynolds, it's just been out a month, so I don't know how many of you read it yet, but I thought Reynolds is very effective in this new biography of Brown, among other things, at showing us just what a violent place Kansas was in the 1850s. That's the most detailed narrative I've ever read of bleeding Kansas. He did some extraordinary things with the sources to show us what a vigilante frontier, brutal frontier war this was. And after you read enough of that, the context sort of overwhelms you that you're not surprised by Pottawatomie. You're not surprised. I mean, very often when we tell the story of Pottawatomie Creek, you know, it's this isolated moment when John Brown snapped. He hears about Charles Sumner being beaten on the floor of the Senate in spring of 1856. And the great abolitionist is beaten nearly senseless by Preston Brooks from South Carolina. It was a caning in the 19th century sense for our friends from abroad who aren't aware of how the code duello and this notion of honor played out sometimes, particularly among Southerners, although not exclusively among Southerners, in duels with pistols or often sometimes in physical beatings of the person who had wronged your relative. And anyway, the way we often tell the story of Pottawatomie Creek in Kansas is that Brown snaps when he hears about the killing or the beating of Charles Sumner, and he goes into a rage, and he decides to visit this area along Pottawatomie Creek where a lot of pro-slavery people live, and he orders five of them murdered with broadswords and cold blood in front of their families. They are brutal killings. They are murders. They were criminal acts. I don't know anything else you could call it. But when you read enough of the context of what's going on in Kansas and why Brown and his five sons went there in the first place, it doesn't surprise you. And it is reciprocal violence. It is retribution for other violence. I'm not justifying it. I'm merely trying to point out that context is all. And we've had a devil of a time, haven't we, with what happened on September 11th and with what's happened ever since. Whenever you stand up in this country now and try to say, maybe we should try to understand the terrorist, you don't get too far. One brief story. I was in a meeting. I'll be very brief. The context was I was asked to be on the board of trustees of the New York Historical Society, and they'd never had any historians. No, they hadn't. Well, the board of trustees are moneyed people. They need money. The place needs, and that's what you put on boards. Well, they decided they're going to have two or three historians, so I had to go to a meeting on the 50th floor of the Morgan Stanley building in the CEO's seminar room, because the CEO of Morgan Stanley was the head of the committee on the board of trustees picking new members of the board. Nice man, Byron Wine. And there are about eight of them there. And they're CEOs and corporate lawyers and Henry Luce III, and Mr. Beekman, and on and on and on. And one of the questions they asked me, they said, you know, we're going to get involved down at Ground Zero with the museum that will be constructed at Ground Zero where the World Trade Towers fell. And he said, there's a big row going on about what that museum should interpret and what it should be about, and they're going to have this thing called Freedom Tower and on and on. And they said, so what do you think they ought to do with that museum? And I said, well, gee, I don't know. You know, my opinion's not worth any more than the next person. I haven't been asked. And they said, no, we want to know what you think. I said, well, I hope it tells a historical narrative of the late 20th century and how this evolution of an Islamic radicalism evolved in the world and how the reputation of the United States, right or wrong, got caught up in the anger and the hatred of part of the Islamic world. I hope it tells an evolutionary, causal, historical narrative of how 9/11 happened. Never forget this. Henry Luce III growled through his glasses and he said, most of us think it should be about freedom. I said, good. Freedom's a malleable and complicated concept. It's good. Let's do freedom. But context. I mean, it doesn't mean you're justifying anybody's acts. The only way to understand violence in history, it seems to me, ultimately, is not purely from our own, although we have to do it this way to begin with. We're equipped with a certain morality, all of us are. We have to approach violence in history from our own morality, but then we have the obligation to know the context of that historical moment in time when it occurred. Sometimes that's why novelists are more important than the historians, because they can sometimes get us deeper into the psyches and emotions of characters and people than the historians allow themselves to do. Finally, what about martyrdom, revolutionary violence, and all these contradictions packaged into one with our man John Brown? Back to all those images of crucifixion and Jacob Lawrence's paintings. The crucifixion, if you think about it now, is the most prevalent icon. I mean, I'm sure we could get up a fight over this about what is the most prevalent icon in all of Western civilization, and I'm inviting the problem here, but it is one of the most prevalent icons in all of Western culture. It has many, many meanings beyond purely, you know, the Christian story. And of course, sacrifice, biblical forms of martyrdom, the apocalyptic conception of history, where God enters history, either for retribution and tearing up, you know, the land and the people and the time and reinventing it, or sometimes for other purposes. That's a very deep, very old, to a great extent Christian, but by no means wholly Christian conception of history. And martyrdom has to somehow be seen in that context. It is central to the Christian view of history. Christians in 19th century America, and this was a Christian country then, were very adept, and we know this once the Civil War breaks out, and because they do it on all sides, South and North, black and white. Americans were very adept at seeing history through a kind of lens of God's design. History is something where God has the power to manipulate deaths and rebirths, rendings and changes. And we don't like that, maybe. I mean, you and I don't want to walk out there right now necessarily believing that there might be a bolt of lightning that will destroy the world and remake it. I mean, can we wait till Monday? I got things to do, you know. I got to finish that essay. I got to, you know, wait till Monday. History as periodic moments of God's retributive justice was something Americans were deeply conditioned for when John Brown strikes and the poets start writing and the song appears. It wasn't as though they were unprepared for a Christian martyr, a man of self-sacrifice. This apocalyptic view of history, moments and times, necessary purgings, rendings, overturnings, which is the very language Brown uses himself in his court appearance. And then the final note that he hands to the jailer just before he goes to the gallows, this nation will be purged with blood, as he says. To a profound degree, most Americans, North and South, black and white, came to see and interpret John Brown and the war in these kinds of biblical or quasi-biblical terms. On one side, to hate him as the Antichrist. And on another side, by no means all Northerners saw John Brown this way, but on the other side, as a Christ-like figure itself. Above all, that image of crucifixion, which Jacob Lawrence apparently could not see John Brown without, is something necessary. Necessary. Now think with me for a moment. When we try to understand the making of the John Brown legend, the making of John Brown the martyr, the uses of martyrdom over time, in the thousands and thousands of ways that it was done, it is worth thinking back to what the crucifixion meant in the first place. There is no Christianity without the crucifixion. There's no story without the cross. There's no cross without the conviction of Jesus and his destruction. He had to be destroyed. Now, one of my favorite speeches on John Brown was given by no less than W.B. Du Bois. It was in 1932 at Harper's Ferry, gathering the NAACP and a host of other people. And Du Bois was the keynote speaker. Du Bois had done other John Brown speeches, and of course had written a book in 1909 on John Brown. But when Du Bois had to speak on Brown, Du Bois decided to take up this image of martyrdom and crucifixion. And in the speech he made at a commemoration at Harper's Ferry in 1932, this is the way Du Bois concluded his own sense of this unsettling, fraught, difficult, but terribly important legacy of Brown. I quote W.B. Du Bois. "Some people," he said, "have the idea that crucifixion consists in the punishment of an innocent man. The essence of crucifixion is that men are killing a criminal, that men have got to kill him, and yet that the act of crucifying him is the salvation of the world. John Brown broke the law. He killed human beings. Those people who defended slavery had to execute John Brown. although they knew that in killing him, they were committing the greater crime. It is out of that human paradise that there comes the meaning of crucifixion. He had to die. The death was necessary. He said it himself in that speech in the courtroom, that one of the most eloquent, you know, impromptu, I suspect he worked on it a little bit maybe ahead of time, but one of the most eloquent impromptu speeches in a public courtroom anyone's ever delivered in the history of American letters. There's that wonderful line where Brown says, "If it be deemed necessary that I should forfeit my life, comma." And then he goes on, he says, "I'm perfectly willing, if it be deemed necessary." I think we're probably here. I think the only way we can in some ways understand this notion of martyrdom is to try to conceive of it as a sacrifice, that if it didn't come from John Brown, it perhaps had to come from someplace else, somewhere else, somehow else, by which America would be forced to face its most vexing, its deepest, its greatest problem, which was slavery in the 19th century. Now, I for one wouldn't go quite as far as David Reynolds does in this recent biography, a book I think a great deal of. Reynolds goes, plays out counterfactuals, which are fun, depending on how far you go with them. He says, if John Brown hadn't lived, well, then there would be no Harper's Ferry. Well, if there was no Harper's Ferry, or if he hadn't lived when he lived, there wouldn't have been Harper's Ferry. If there wasn't Harper's Ferry, there'd have been no secession. If there's no secession, there's no Civil War. If there's no Civil War, slavery would not have ended in the 19th century. And he plays that out and plays that out and plays that out such that everything is tied back to John Brown. I wouldn't quite do that. I wouldn't reorder the entire timeline of American history around our man John Brown. But Reynolds does have a point, that sometimes there are individuals, there certainly are events forged out of the passions of a particular individual or a group that can cause a convulsion, which was Whitman's term for the Civil War, the convulsion, he called it, that can change a society far beyond what anyone would ever have predicted. And that's what Harper's Ferry was. It was the Pearl Harbor of the Civil War, or the 9/11 of something else. It is one of those moments where what comes after it can never quite be the same again. Now, I'll just end where I began. It's a thrill to be here, to share this day with you, and to go out to the gravesite for me for the first time and pay my own personal homage to someone I've been admiring, troubled by, vexed by, but will never stop reading about and maybe writing about as long as I do this. Thank you very much.